Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Worst Church Ever. This is our December 25th episode. And Nathan, I want to be the very first to wish you
happy holidays.
Happy holidays back to you, too. And might I add, I am not in the least bit offended by your use of the phrase happy holidays, because it is a holiday and I am happy.
And also, Nathan, do you also celebrate New Year's?
I do celebrate New Year's. I do.
So, and yeah, and Christmas Eve is its own liturgical thing. And then
that's a Sunday this year, right? So Sunday is a Christmas Eve. So it's also, in some religions, equally important to go to church on Christmas Eve. So that is a holiday in and of itself, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
plurally,
right.
And then even if we don't want to include anybody else, even just us Christians have multiple, you might even say a plurality of holidays, not to mention the 12 days of Christmas, Epiphany, and so on. So happy holidays, Nathan.
Thank you. Maybe it's not the worst greeting ever.
But also, Merry Christmas.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Merry Christmas to you, too. Christ's Mass, is that correct?
Yes.
Is that the history of
that
term?
That is correct.
I've heard that Christ was not actually born on December 25th.
Ooh, I'm so glad you brought this up. Do you mind if I say something about that?
Yeah, I was hoping you would, actually. That's why I commented on it.
Hey, that's how this works. So, two things. One, serious Christians don't care, right? Like, when he was born, because that's not the point. The point is that he was born. But I've always been under the assumption that it was just an arbitrary day that was picked, either because it was near the solstice or because whatever, we need the light when it's the darkest, and all those reasons that all cultures have those celebrations, those festivals of light. But interestingly, if the annunciation to Zechariah of the coming of his son John the Baptist, if that occurred during Yom Kippur, then if you do the math, it would make sense that John was born at the end of June, that Jesus was born at the end of December. Now, Yom Kippur, we don't know if it was Yom Kippur, but we know that Zechariah was in the temple performing certain rites.
Yeah.
And the language in Luke indicates that it may have been one of the holidays where only the priests go in and the public is outside, worshiping outside of the innermost areas.
Yeah.
And so there are some people who think that, yeah, it was Yom Kippur. It seems to track. And then it also turns out that the early church, by the 120s AD, was celebrating Christ's nativity. I don't know if they celebrated it in December,
right,
but they made a point of saying, yeah. So if the early church in the apostolic age was within more or less the living memory of these events, who knows? It very well could have been in December. So on the one hand, I like to push back at people who are like, it's not really in December. But then also, I don't want to push back because I don't really care. But I think it's interesting that it may have been, and I think it doesn't matter if it was or wasn't.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. It's this day that we can all wrap our heads around. And if it didn't happen to be the 25th, so what?
Exactly.
We can still celebrate it on the 25th because, you know, it's not like it's actually spelled out there. So I say that kind of with jest, but I did have this friend that posted this meme the other day, and it had some of the origins of Christian holidays and Christian traditions within Christmas. And I had like the candy cane and the Christmas tree and all that other stuff. And I got a good chuckle out of it because some of the things that were on there were very meaningful, and some of them were meaningful for not just Christians, mm-hmm, but also other people. So I thought it might be fun to maybe just talk through some of those traditions. And I just want to kind of preface this and say, this is not to say that you can't celebrate the Christmas tree, because I think if you find meaning in the Christmas tree, whether you find meaning in it because you happen to have a Christian tradition, or if you happen to be pagan and you find it meaningful because of the fertility and all that stuff that it might mean for a different holiday, it's cool as humans that we find meaning in these symbols. And so I thought maybe we could just throw some Christian symbols around and see which ones we find meaning in, and maybe if we know what the origins are, and it might be a fun way to spend a little bit of Christmas cheer together.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
So to speak. So yeah. I don't know, Christmas tree. Want to start with that one? Any thoughts? Like, I had a little bit of research I did on the Christmas tree, but not a lot. I don't know.
What did you find about O Tannenbaum?
So it seems like there's a lot of different cultures that actually celebrate it, have a lot of interest in bringing evergreen things into an otherwise dark place.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter if it was the Romans having this tradition where they'd bring wreaths and branches into homes around certain holidays that might have happened around December, or if it was maybe first century Christians who just liked that idea and they brought them into their homes to spruce things up. You like what I did there? Yeah, certainly there is a really strong evidence that there was a lot of that stuff going on. The Druids had some things, the Germans had some different ideas on these things. So it's like not universally this group, but this particular tradition really had this idea of taking something that was otherwise dull and dreary and these days that are forlorn and long and not really hospitable and trying to create life and light within a space. And so having maybe some spiritual application to that is cool, like bringing life to dark places, bringing light to dark places.
I think you're right. I think endemic to human nature is doing that, using nature to enliven our surroundings, like you said, to make dark spaces light. So, and even just for very practical purposes. So in the Middle Ages, maybe your house wouldn't smell as bad if you brought a tree in there for a few weeks or something, right? But so, yeah, I think every culture does this, has done this. And I think in the Christian tradition, I think the first evidence of Christmas trees as such was done by German Christians in the Middle Ages, which you alluded to. And they were consciously doing it as a celebration of the birth of Jesus, right? And that's what's important is,
yeah,
no matter where the tradition comes from, why are you doing it? And it's very easy to look at adjacent traditions from all around the world and say, oh, well, because that tradition existed here, it must have been copied and therefore it's not legitimate. But it's also true that people, no matter how different we are, we also have a lot of the same tendencies and same rhythms, especially
right,
if you live in the same part of the world. So there's no real direct evidence that, for example, the Yule log is the forerunner of the Christmas tree. We just don't know. But I think there's also this weird imperialism from people on two different sides of these questions. Like, so during the English Revolution, when Cromwell came into power,
yeah,
right, the Puritans outlawed Christmas trees and all celebrations of Christmas because they felt that it was too Catholic, right? And also, it was a time when people made merry and the Puritans thought you should be working and all this other stuff.
That's right.
So you have people, let's just say, from a, and this is a bad word, this is a bad label, but conservative, right? Who
right,
are like, you can't do Christmas stuff because it's pagan, right? And if it's not in the Bible, you can't do it, right?
Right.
And then you have people who are militantly not Christian who say the same thing. They're
right,
like, you can't do that. Don't you know it's pagan? It's like, don't we get to define how we celebrate? And what does that say about cultures who have embraced Christianity that are not from the Northern Hemisphere or the Western
right,
Hemisphere.
Right.
And they're going to use mangoes or they're going to use whatever else they're going to use. Don't you know that's not in the, that's not the point.
That's
and
right.
So we find ourselves in this weird space where you get critiqued from everybody who wants to play this game of you're not doing it right.
This is a moment where we're supposed to be joyful and regardless of whether or not you're a secular practitioner of Christmas or
yep,
a very serious, astute practitioner of Christmas, there's room for joy in all those different places. And hey, so I got another one. Mr. Claus himself.
Yes. Sinterklaas.
Sinterklaas.
Der Belschnickel.
Yeah, a couple different origins for him. So
yeah,
I think the more traditional Christian one would be Saint Nicholas.
Right.
Who had this incredible testimony of generosity and caring and really trying to make sure that people that didn't have things were actually getting what they needed, right? So there was this very social justice at its very infancy. But there's also Odin, who has this Norse myth. Yeah, there you go. We got Odin right here in front of us with that beard. So you got this guy flying around with this long beard.
It's the tradition of the great hunt, right?
Yeah.
Where they're flying in the sky and they're hunting. I don't know if they're hunting stags, but this the part of it that's magical and mystical and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have this hybrid of those two. And then Coca-Cola enters the world in, I don't know, it was probably the 20s or 30s. We don't actually have this red suited, hello, red hat, big guy until really, I think Coca-Cola actually did the branding for that. So thanks to Coke, we actually have this idea of the big fat man in the suit with the whole shebang that we've got today. I don't know. Did you ever tell your kids about Santa? Or do you?
Man, I'll tell you, I struggled with this because I was like, it's like that Simpsons thing where it's like, just kidding about Santa, but Jesus is real. You know what I mean?
No.
And it's like on the sign at church on one of the Sundays in the show. And so I struggled with it a lot when my first son was little. And we decided we weren't going to tell him about Santa because we're like, we're not going to lie to this kid and, you know, everything else. And it's going to, you know, it's going to be like foundational trauma, right?
Yeah.
And then he was like two and he came to us and he was like, oh, is this what Santa brought me? And we were like, how do you know about Santa? He's like, yeah, I know about Santa. Like he knew it from maybe from his nursery school or just from TV, whatever it was. And he's like, yeah, that came from Santa. So then we were like, you know what? We had Santa growing up. It was fun. It didn't destroy me mentally. So maybe I should lighten up a little bit. Then we ran with it. But I was conflicted, and I still am, but I think it's probably harmful.
And that may unpack like a lot of the things that we've talked about recently. Like your belief in Santa getting destroyed maybe is the root of all of this. That's where this podcast came from.
Oh my gosh, you're totally right.
Yeah.
I have a friend who told me that when she had kids, she was going to tell the kids the truth about Santa, is that, yep, there was a Santa, but now he's dead.
Well, I
mean, because it's St. Nick.
Yeah, St. Nicholas. Yeah, it definitely was. Yeah. Yeah, I had a similar experience growing up. My parents didn't tell me about Santa Claus, but I don't think they necessarily kept him from me. But apparently I came home similar to your son and just announced that Santa was bringing gifts. And so if you choose not to tell your kids about Santa, you better never take them out of the house because they're gonna find out, right?
That's really good, yeah.
I hope kids aren't listening to this because we don't want to be the ones breaking the news, but there is...
Please don't let your kids listen to this.
Yeah, this is spoiler alert. There's going to be some... Turn the earmuffs on before we say this. I quickly went from an avid believer in Santa Claus to a missionary against Santa's existence the moment I found out that he wasn't real.
You were that kid.
I was that kid. I seem to recall the next door neighbor's parents not being very happy that I may have spilled the beans that Santa Claus wasn't real.
Was that Becky?
That was Becky. So
of
Becky.
Course. Sorry, Becky.
Sorry, Becky, if you happen to be listening. Sorry that I ruined Christmas for you. The miracle was over.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I didn't know. I didn't know that everybody else didn't know. I apparently didn't. I apparently was prophesized into the religion and then out of the religion later on. So anyway.
So you were like a scorned fundamentalist. Who...
Yeah. I hesitated to call like the deconstruction of Santa Claus because I think deconstruction has within it this idea that you build it back up into something else. You tear it apart and then you reorganize it around how it makes sense. And I think in that case, it was just burning it to the ground. It was just done for me.
It was like you buy everything hook, line, and sinker. And then when you realize that particular kind of epistemology or whatever doesn't really work anymore, then you have to tell all the Christians about how Christmas trees are pagan, right?
Yes, I went around making sure that everyone knew that Santa Claus was not actually part of the canon in scripture. And so... how traumatic is this for kids? I went to one of these little Bible studies for kids after school with somebody at our church, and she writes Santa's name on this like whiteboard, and she's like,
I know where this is going. I have a guess. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. She's like, just so you know, if you move the letters around, it also spells Satan. She didn't say it quite as nefariously as I just did. That was a little bit more dramatic effect. But it was definitely this very, I don't know. If you tell your kids about Santa Claus and you want to have the thing where somebody's giving these gifts, I think that's a wonderful thing to have this place where somebody's unexpectedly delighted by things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And make it a teachable moment that Santa Claus, Saint Nick, did that because of Jesus. That's a good actual teaching tool right there.
Yeah. Just like the evergreen tree. But I celebrate anyone who wants to celebrate Santa Claus. And I saw a couple of good Santa Claus movies lately that I just really enjoyed. I think there's, I don't have anyone in particular that I want to endorse, but I think a good Santa Claus movie is great. But I will tell you that if you watch any recent Santa Claus film that's been filmed within the last 10 years, Santa always ends up in jail.
With Steven Van Zandt sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. But it's just weird. It's like Santa can't deliver the presents for some reason. Somebody needs to help him out, and he ends up in jail. Like, every single one of these things just have to be like the same script writer that's just churning them out, because Santa's always in prison at some point.
Exactly.
For different reasons, but he always ends up in jail. So.
Yeah. And isn't that what we do to generosity, Nathan? Don't we imprison it?
What a symbol. Thanks,
How
man.
About that?
That's great. All right. So I got a couple that are a little closer to the actual nativity. So these are actually ones that we probably find in scripture. But so actually, these are just questions. And I think you know the answer to all of these. But when Mary and Joseph are going on their journey to Bethlehem to register to be taxed or for a census or whichever reading you want to have, what did she ride on?
I want to say donkey, but I know that's not in the Bible.
So we have the donkey in our traditions, right? And every nativity set that you have has the donkey there.
Yeah.
But there isn't actually a reference to a donkey anywhere in scripture. It doesn't mean she didn't ride in on a donkey.
Right.
But I hope that doesn't destroy anybody's picture of the nativity, that she may have walked, right? They were poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
They may not have been able to afford a donkey. So
that's true.
That might kickstart labor, by the way.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, not saying that you walked, but there's a good chance that there was a donkey. I don't know if there was or not, but
And it's because it's not in the story, it's probably not fundamental to the story. It's interesting what's included in scripture and what's not. And it's funny how different theological schools will say, oh, well, we don't have any evidence of X, but because of context, it must be Y.
Yeah,
and we don't really know. So, and we do this to build our own edifices of like why our theology is right. And I have to watch out that I don't do that, because you see it everywhere.
Yep.
Oh, well, they really weren't in a stall and it wasn't really an inn. And so your whole celebration is totally invalid. And it's lighten the hell up. When non-Western cultures adapt the Christmas story to their setting, no one says anything. But when Western culture gets it wrong and we make a European barn, we get the finger wags. And it's okay, as long as we're all clear that Jesus really didn't have blonde hair and blue eyes, that's as long as we're really clear that it didn't have to look like this for it to be significant and true and real. And by the way, who has time, I'm a pastor, so I do this and I get paid to do this, but who has time to make sure that they have every single interpretive nuance correct before they can celebrate the birth of God in history, right?
Yeah. So what I think is interesting about what you just said about the blonde hair, blue eye, and I agree, Jesus did not have blonde hair and blue eyes. Actually, there's not a recorded, we don't know, he could have.
Right.
Right? It's not
right.
He
could have been an anomaly, right?
Unlikely, but we don't know.
Yeah.
What I do think
and
is
nothing hinges on that. That would have probably, it's probably the last thing God would do is show up as an Aryan in Jerusalem.
Right, because that would have been quite an oddity.
Yeah.
However, is it possible? Sure. But what I do think is interesting is, like, in Western culture, and especially in, like, North American culture or European culture, he shows up as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed little baby. And if you go to Asia, he does not show up that way in pictures of the nativity. He shows up not looking like a Middle Easterner either. He shows up looking the people that are celebrating this. And if you go to South America, he looks like he's South American. And if you go to Africa, he looks African. No matter where you go in the planet, people that celebrate Jesus tend to show him like them.
Right.
And I guess we could have a critique of Westerners saying, like, oh, we want this blonde hair, blue eyed Jesus. True. But I think the idea behind it is, like, it's not necessarily that people are like trying to cast Jesus as an Aryan white person. I think what we're all doing is we're subconsciously realizing there's this advent of a moment where something that's different and other suddenly becomes like us. And that's profound. And so if I grapple with that, of course, then I'm blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and I think about Jesus as potentially looking like me, because that's what's familial Mm-hmm. And that's what's close.
Yeah. Yes. And that does not take away from the fact that has that particular image of Christ been used for racist purposes? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
But there's also this embedded racism of the critique, right? And this is where I say that I'm a progressive. And what I'm going to say might not sound progressive because maybe it's too progressive for progressives. But like, if you only critique the white West for
right.
making Jesus in their image, that's like saying, well, we expect all these other cultures to do that, but you should know better.
Yeah. It's
and that's racist to everybody else, right?
Right. You're not enlightened enough to realize how wrong this is, almost. Is that the subtext?
Yeah. Like, we expect other cultures to do that, and they should, and we should celebrate that. But we in the West,
we should know better.
And part of that is because the U.S. is a product of the Enlightenment. For all of its faults and everything else, it is self-consciously in its founding a product of the Enlightenment and of rationalism. Just as much as it was founded by farmers who believed in Jesus, it was also founded by philosophers who were deists, right?
Right.
Or atheists. And so baked into the U.S. is this idea that we're different. We don't have traditional culture. We don't have these long histories of things. So therefore, everything we do can only be viewed through the lens of it being racist. And wherever it deviates from rationalism, it's critiqued. So rationally, we know Jesus wasn't a Westerner. And so we can critique that within Western settings, but we dare not critique that in any other setting. And I wouldn't personally, because I think it's beautiful. I think it's beautiful that there are Christians in Sri Lanka in the fifth century, and they're portraying Jesus as Sri Lankan, and in China, and anywhere else you go.
That's right.
Like, that's the point. Like, you said it so beautifully that here God is become like us, whoever the us is. And the U.S. is a place where, also self-consciously, and this is a hard-fought battle that we haven't really won, but we are trying to be a country that's not an ethno-state, right?
Right.
And a lot of these other countries are or have been. And so the critique is built into that tension, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're majority, or we have been at least majority Euro, not to mention the fact that a good part of the country was and always has been Mexican and indigenous and everything else. But the left holds this project to a higher standard in the U.S. and in Western Europe than it does anywhere else. And it's almost as if to say secular rationalism is best, and we will indulge non-secular rationalism from other cultures, but our culture is too good for that. And that comes straight from white men in the 16 and 1700s. And the left doesn't like to talk about that so much. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's a good point. You have to sometimes leave space just for joy. And not everything has to be a critique.
And
social
room
goods.
And space and allowing cultures to do what they do. Now, one of the problems in the West, unfortunately, is that when the gospel came to Western Europe, it was immediately contextualized into the warrior knight system.
Right.
And even the translations of the gospel were militarized.
Yeah.
Because that was the setting. That produced a lot of bad stuff. And that produced most of the things that are problematic about Western Christianity, I would say.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, let's critique that all day long. And let's critique all of this. But that's also, here's the hard part. Can you have grace and empathy for the 12th century chieftain or knight who hears the story of Jesus and sees it in his terms? That, for some reason, seems harder than to have that same kind of empathy for people who are in poverty in the developing world, or what we used to call the third world. I don't know. But that peasant who was living hand to mouth day to day in his own shit had it just as hard as the person in the global South right now who's experiencing economic injustice and climate injustice and everything else. So we tend not to hold space for everybody equally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's well said. And it also reminds me of Monty Python.
Hard
turn, but I mean, just to go back to the nativity for a second.
Please.
Since it is our Christmas edition, I know we've been talking about trauma. We've been talking about the idea of watching trauma play out in different stories that we see in the Bible. And I think there's some trauma even in the nativity that's spelled out there. There's some different things there. And it's like, what do you think about that idea that like even the birth of Christ, there's moments of trauma both on an individual level, but there's also some like generational trauma.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really good question because when you mentioned it off screen, the first thing I thought of was the body trauma of birth.
Dude.
And I didn't think about it from Mary's perspective because I'm like a self-centered man. I thought about it from the perspective of a baby and the trauma of birth from the baby standpoint. Okay, I'm in the womb and everything is provided for me. I do nothing. Everything is warm and safe. It's also precarious, but we don't know that when we're in the womb, right?
Right.
And now I am quite literally pushed out or ripped into time and space.
Yeah.
And I go from this literal, visceral connection with my mother to having that separated, and I'm now cold for the first time. I'm breathing for the first time. I'm hungry for the first time. I make a bowel movement for the first time. All these other things. And so how does that work when the baby we're talking about, we believe, is God in the flesh among us, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, from that perspective, God, if God's going to enter our story in a meaningful way, he has to enter into our trauma. And the very first thing God does, which is to be born, is traumatic from the baby or from God's perspective. It's welcome to earth, like Will Smith in Independence Day.
Yeah.
Welcome to earth, and it's going to be hard for the rest of your time here. So there's that trauma, which I think is profound. And there are lots of people who study the bioscience of all this and say that, yeah, birth itself is a fundamentally traumatic experience. And then, of course, Nathan, there's, I think, what you were alluding to, which is the trauma of displacement, right?
Yeah.
These both Mary and Joseph are both in the lineage and line of King David. And so
yeah,
there's the irony of this dynastic connection, but here they are peasants. They are coming to pay tribute to a traumatizing occupier. They have the trauma of the journey. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on those aspects. And then also there's the whole afterbirth stuff that happens, the killing of all those kids, the flight to Egypt, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, and this is a strange thing to leave your house and have to go to a different town to be registered. From my understanding, it's not clearly spelled out exactly where they were prior to getting to Bethlehem.
Right.
So it could have been like a few miles. It could have been all the way across the other side of the country. We're not really exactly sure. So you may have some research on that you could share. I think that'd be great. But at the same time, regardless of the situation, here they are having to go to a place where there's not room for them. Like now, again, I don't know if that's they had distant relatives and they had to stay with them, or there really wasn't room in the inn, or whatever was going on. Clearly is like some mass migrations of people going on here. So I think that's trauma in and of itself. I can't imagine being in a place here in the United States. We do a census, what, every 10 years? Is that? Could you imagine if every 10 years you had to go back to wherever you were born?
Right.
Or wherever your dad was born. So that would be for you.
Yeah,
right?
The ancestral home, yeah.
Right, the ancestral home. So having to go back there. That kind of burden is just insurmountable. I know, and this is changing it to the United States for a second, but I've heard people talking about people that are in poverty and saying, well, why don't you just leave to go where the jobs are?
Yes.
Like, why don't you just move out of wherever you are, that's this abandoned old Rust Belt town, and just go to the city where the jobs are, not realizing, like, just the kind of financial resources it takes to take a trip like that, especially when you're pregnant, right? But to take a trip. So we're talking about like an incredible, probably financial investment on this family's part just to go do something that was required. We're talking about people that were not wealthy. These are like Joseph and Mary were not wealthy individuals. So you're talking about potentially impoverishing them further just to get them to this place. And you're also removing them. And I'm making an assumption here that Mary's family was not with her. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if you're going with your now husband, it's a good chance that you're not necessarily going with your parents.
Yeah, right. You're probably going back to, it just so happens that Bethlehem is the ancestral homeland of both of them. But yes, had she not been of the line of David, I'm sure she would have just gone wherever Joseph went. They're not going two places.
Yeah, so
that's not happening.
Yeah, actually, so I guess maybe that thought isn't exactly where it is. Like, maybe she did have some help with her, right?
Yeah, but we really don't know.
All we know is that
Elizabeth knew.
Yeah.
That's it.
But yeah. I just think about that. That sounds like a really lonely experience.
Yeah.
To be leaving, to have to go someplace, to be, I don't know, dysregulated through this process, and then suddenly have to go through what is, for both the baby and for a mother. I've watched my wife give birth a couple of times, and although she is glad to have all our children, it is not a tremendously fun experience to give birth,
right?
And then to have give birth in a place that's not your choosing. This isn't where she probably wanted to have a baby, and it may not have the people around her that she wanted to have around her, and what a lonely moment.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's well said. And even if they're surrounded by a caravan of kinsfolk, right?
Yeah.
It's still, she has this unique knowledge that she's carrying the Messiah. Nobody else is carrying the Messiah.
Right.
And if you're Joseph, right? Okay, what do the people around you, if you're traveling with family, what do they really think about how your wife got pregnant, right? So I think even if they're in the midst of a lot of kin, I think they could both still be feeling very alienated and very alone on this journey. And
yeah,
let's assume that I don't think we know for certain, and I can't recall if the Bible spells this out or not because I didn't look again, but let's assume that Joseph and Mary had made their home prior to this in Nazareth, which is where they end up anyway. Even if they're going just from Nazareth to Bethlehem, that's too much for somebody who's 9 months pregnant. Even if they were going from Nazareth, Pennsylvania to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is comparatively a hop, skip, and a jump, you're going on foot, or if you're going on a donkey or whatever you're going on in the 9th month of pregnancy, that's a traumatic experience, no matter how you look at it, because it can only be so good, right?
Correct.
Especially in those days in that setting.
Yeah, I mean, I remember from the pregnancy that my wife went through, just the last couple of weeks, there's not a lot of walking that you're wanting to do.
Right.
Right. And so regardless of what the situation was, that's got to be an uncomfortable thing. So I think I wanted to just sit on that for a second, because what I think is really interesting about that moment when the birth happens, there's this secondary story that's happening that we probably all know about, because there's these shepherds that are out in the flocks who are also in a very lonely state, right? It's a very lonely job to be a shepherd. You're on the outskirts of society. It's a kind of a smelly job. You're really raising animals that are going to be slaughtered in sacrifice or eaten or used for wool. And so the angels come to this also very lonely group of individuals that are watching their flocks by night. And there's this moment where I imagine two lonely groups are finding each other. Two marginalized peoples are having this intersection of celebration. Like, why did the angels choose to go to the shepherds? I think because the shepherds represent a marginalized people within a marginalized people. And so for them to be the first ones that show up, or the first ones that kind of celebrate outside of this family unit, is cool, that you've got these two groups of people who know what it's like to be very different and very alone.
Hmm.
They can see each other very clearly.
And Mary and Joseph are called to care for the one who will be called the Lamb of God, right? And the shepherds, of course, are caring for the literal lambs. And obviously, the imagery of Christ as Good Shepherd comes out of some of this, too. I think that's really good, Nathan. And you know what it reminds me of, going back to one of these more medieval traditions, is it represents a complete inversion of expectation.
Yeah.
And of, like, social convention, that the people, you said it well, the marginalized of the marginalized are the ones that God himself, God Almighty, or the angels make this revelation to. And they are the ones that the angel chorus is encouraging and revealing this news to. Just like how in the resurrection story, it's not the people we call apostles that get the message first. It's the women who were otherwise forgotten and mistreated, right? So the marginalized of the marginalized are the ones to whom this good news is first given. And that's no accident. But it reminds me of, do you know, and this is a word I always wondered what it was. Do you know what the word wassailing means? Here we come a wassailing, that whole thing.
Oh,
do you know what wassailing was?
Yeah, tell me.
I'd never really realized this, but it was basically people who were in the lower classes would wassail, which meant to go to the upper classes on Christmas and demand to be given food, drink, and provision. And it represented a complete inversion of social norms and hierarchy. And that's one of the reasons, apparently, that the Puritans also hated Christmas, because they did not want the social hierarchy inverted, because in their thinking, well, if you're wealthy, it's because you're among the elect, right?
That's right.
If you're successful, it's because you're among the elect. And if you're not, then it's because you're garbage.
Right.
And the gospel completely inverts that.
Yeah.
From the very beginning. And Christians are very good at missing that. And the Christmas story does it right out of the gate. It inverts everything, as if to say two things. One, this is about establishing God's real kingdom, which isn't Herod's chief fiefdom. It's not Rome's empire. It's actually the kingdom of God, which is in us and all around us, and is motivated by the high being brought low and the low being brought high. The first shall be last. All these things that humankind does that we think are right and good and show our worth and our dignity actually don't. And yeah. We have innate dignity because we're like made in God's image, all that stuff. So it's this social inversion that's key to the gospel mission. But then it also, I think, even just in a literary way, the entrance of eternity, of God's self into time and space, can do nothing but totally disrupt and invert everything that it encounters, which is why if there are four different gospel accounts of the resurrection, for example, and they differ in number of angels and details of this, and that's okay, because the act of the incarnation and of the resurrection is so jarring and so much of a displacement of ordered time and space and history that we don't know what to make of it. Everything gets jumbled up and confused in a good and holy way.
That's really well said. I think there's a misconception for at least modern readers of older stories that stories need to have the same level of scrutiny as an article that we'd see in the newspaper about a neighbor setting fire to another neighbor's truck, right? And you have the police there, and you have all these records, and reporters are there, and 17 other people are like filming it at the same time. And so we've got these records that exist, but that story is going to be retold over and over again. And 15, 20 years later, there's a different kind of memory that you probably have. And the way that you remember it and the way that somebody else remembered it, it's probably a little different, but you still have the same story. You're still like, yeah, this neighbor did something crazy to the other neighbor. And I think that's the same thing that's going on in a lot of these stories that we're looking at. It's we've got four different perspectives that are coming together, and it's been processed through different lenses. And yet the consistencies far outweigh the inconsistencies, right?
Well, yeah. And not only that, but the fact that that these stories are testimonies through flesh and blood, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's the whole point of the incarnation, is
right.
Not that we get everything exactly right, but here's God in our mess and in our space, and it's going to change everything, and it's going to be, in some ways, inscrutable. So God comes to us in the most scrutable way possible as one of us, but it still is so disruptive. I mean, just think about the quantum physics of it, right? There's John Milton has this amazing poem that I try to read every year around this time. It's called On the Morning of Christ's Nativity. And it's all about this idea that the coming of Christ totally disrupts time.
Yeah.
And everything is happening at the same time. So the nativity of 0 or 1 or 2 CE AD is also the nativity, the morning Milton is writing it, is also the moment when the entrance of eternity makes all the old gods flee and all their temples crumble and all this other stuff. It's really powerful. And it also mimics the theme of Philippians 2, which is God literally entering again into our space. The words that Paul uses are probably from an early Christian liturgy in Philippians 2, where he says God didn't consider his godhood something that was discernible, and so he steps into our darksome places, basically. So if Christian tradition really taught at its core that the Bible is 100% literal and was dictated to us from on high, right?
Right.
Word for word. Well, it would be the Quran. It wouldn't be the Bible. It would be the Book of Mormon. It wouldn't be what we actually have. And the crazy thing is, again, from people who view themselves as fundamentalist, true Christians on one side, to people who just hate anything theistic on the other. We've seen this in our social media.
That's right.
Both sides think they need to tell us, oh, you have to believe the Bible literally, because then we can, from the fundamentalist side, if you don't, you're not a Christian. And from the militant anti-theistic side, it's, oh, you can't say you're a Christian and also be progressive, because to be a Christian means you have to be the fundamentalist, and we're going to critique you only on that. So it's so much more interesting and holy than all that, because it's not that cut and dried. And like you said, Nathan, we have this idea that ancient stories are supposed to be held up to the same scrutiny, but as modern news stories or as modern court statements. But one of the things that the postmodern movement has actually blessed Christianity with is the recovery of pre-modern ways of understanding these things.
Yeah.
And the balance of Christian tradition has never viewed these things as the way fundamentalists beginning in the 20th century have. So, hallelujah.
Yeah. We probably can do like a whole series on that, because now we're broaching into a topic that like is equally interesting to me. Like the biblical narratives are like top of the list, and then probably continental and postmodern philosophy being a close second, because there's not equally disruptive, because I think the birth, life, and death of Jesus is the fundamental thing to me that's more disruptive than almost anything else that we've seen in history. But like I'd say, like,
yeah,
the recovery of philosophy, I think that's a term that probably, I like that term. I'm going to use that from now on. The recovery of philosophy from, again, the continental philosophers onto the postmoderns, who basically looked and said, hey, Descartes, that's great. Like, thank you for blessing us with rational thought and all that sort of stuff. But the entire system that you built this on, like, has so many presuppositions on it. We got to go back to the beginning and just be like, hey, what does it actually mean to even exist? What does that even mean? What does it mean to even be a human and to actually understand these things? And so, yeah, I think that's really well said. And I think, like, nativity is an invitation to that. Birth, celebration of birth, celebration of Advent is like a moment where we get to see people, Mary and Joseph, shepherds, magi. By the way, how many magi were there?
I know.
Both of us are like shrugging. There's three gifts, but we don't know many. There could have been 60 magi. There could have been six. There could have been three. It really makes it would be a really busy nativity set with 60 magi coming in. Be like the army just descending.
That would have been, thinking of the way my Italian family celebrates Christmas, that would have been the Italian nativity. It's 60 magi and like 600 pounds of food and Mary doing most of the work.
Yeah, probably. But when you see this, there's something really very human about this, because there's like this fundamental moment when you watch new life being brought into the world that's just a call to be human. And I think that's such a remarkable thing, that in this moment, we've got a displaced family, we've got marginalized folks, and then we have magi probably representing something more elite.
Yeah. And also, by the way, not part of the covenant of Israel.
Right. And outside the promise, so to speak, all coming together and just having this moment. Now, did it happen at the same night? Probably not, right? But it's really nice to visualize that and see it, the confluence of all those things coming together. And that is a picture of what I think a reimagining, so to speak, of the garden. Like, this is it, right? It's people from all places and all times celebrating life together for a moment, right? And so the nativity set, the little collection that you have, is just such a really cool picture of like people coming together in celebration of life. And I just think that was so exciting to God when he was like looking down at that and just being like, this is what I made you for.
You're totally right. And thinking about it too, in terms of, okay, we have the wise men here at the manger and it's the wrong day, and maybe it was weeks later, maybe it was years later. But it goes back to that idea too of collapsing space and time, and it's all happening together.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Hey, before we jump off, Christmas carols. We talked about Lost Sailing, right?
Yeah.
And which, if I'm not mistaken, became what we consider Christmas caroling today. I think that was sort
of... I think that's right.
So, like, that sort of inversion of hospitality and demanding food and all that sort of stuff, like, it eventually became Christmas
Bring us
caroling.
Our figgy pudding.
Bring us our figgy pudding. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Eventually became, like, what would become Christmas caroling. And so, Christmas carols...
Which is a re-inversion, because now you're coming singing carols to bless people, not to demand to be blessed, right?
That's yeah, like... yeah. And by the way, it probably should be continually inverting, because once somebody has power, yeah, right, and someone else doesn't, there should be an inversion, but then that person has power, so it should always be inverting, always. Anyway, that said,
yep,
maybe we should,
yep.
Yep. Why don't we wrap up with Christmas carols and favorite Christmas music, Christmas songs? You got some?
Well, yeah, but first I want to do a little plug. I got this from the organist at church for my birthday.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you can see this.
Oh,
Jesus on Twitter, 12 followers. What's it say? 12 followers so far. Sweet. I say this to say, subscribe to the podcast.
That's right.
Come check us out on Facebook, where all hell is broken loose.
For those of you that don't follow us on Facebook yet, there are two groups of people on Facebook that are very active on the Worst Church Ever forums, and that are people that are fundamentalist Christians that just cannot believe that something progressive would be associated with the word church, and people who are anti-theists who cannot believe that anyone associates with God. So it's like there's these two, like, Worst Church Ever is been the confluence of just both of those groups, and it's been rather interesting to see that. So it's to each group,
yep,
just listen, you might find something you enjoy.
And happy holidays.
And happy holidays. So Chris, favorite Christmas songs, what's yours?
So my favorite worshipful Christmas song from a devotional perspective is Oh Holy Night. I love it. I think the lyrics are amazing. Again, they talk about breaking the chains of bondage and slavery and all that stuff. That's my favorite sort of like confessional one. In terms of like secular or more secular thing, Merry Christmas Baby by Bruce Springsteen, his version of it. But I want to start a thing where the Mandela effect, Nathan,
yeah,
you know what that is,
yeah,
right?
It's like where you remember things like differently than they actually were.
Right. So a famous example is people think that the Bernstein Bears are the Bernstein Bears. So today my wife mentioned the Mandela effect, but she called it the Mandala effect, which blew my mind because that's like the exact example. But anyway, I want to start a Mandela effect that I'm going to call Bruce Springsteen, Bruce Springsteen from
Bruce,
now on,
Bruce
like the Bernstein Bears. So yeah, I want to see if it'll catch on. Oh, it was always Bruce Springsteen. You didn't.
Yeah.
So Merry Christmas Baby by Bruce Springsteen. And then I love the medley that Bare Naked Ladies and Sarah McLachlan do of We Three Kings and God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Those are probably my top four, I guess, top three, whatever. What about you?
I've got three that I'll say. I'm actually pretty close to you on Holy Night. I think it's just such a beautiful song. It's just hard not to just fall in love with that one. So I'm actually right there with you on that one.
And I think I really first became aware of it, not in church, but from Home Alone.
Oh, really? I actually forgot that song was in. Oh, is that where he's sitting on the in the service and
when they're in the church
and having that moment where they like finally figure each other out? Is that the moment, or is it during the rehearsals? Yep.
The guy that he's afraid of, the neighbor, they is in the rehearsal because his son and daughter won't let him. But
it's
about reconciliation and understanding. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Like you said, there's just such rich lyrical content to that song. I just think it's just really amazing. So I'm going to go, and it's beautiful. Like, it's just, it's hard not to really love that. The other one that I really enjoy, actually, I got to go to two, because one's really not a Christmas song. So I'm going to save that one for last, because I do want to get your thoughts on that. So I really like it, but it's not truly, it's Die Hard.
Yeah.
So I'll get to that one. But the other one is Santa Claus is Coming to Town, but not the Jackson 5 version. I like the Boss doing it.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
It's just like the whole intro with, hope you've been good. Hope maybe Santa will bring you a new brand new saxophone. And then it starts out and it's just, it's good. And then suddenly at the end, it's just,
it's so good. Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen. So the Boss, both of our favorite Christmas songs.
Yeah.
Hey, happy holidays.
Merry Christmas. We will be back again. We're going to figure out if we're going to do a New Year's episode. Ooh, did you know that in Soviet Russia, they had a New Year's spruce?
Bringing it all back. They spruced up the place.
We could talk about resolutions, and one of mine is to not engage with people who are not engaging in good faith and care about nuance. There, I said it. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert for those of you that haven't been on Facebook lately.
We want to thank everybody for joining us for this episode. Nathan, thank you.
Yeah.
And check us out on the socials and give us a that would be a great Christmas present. It's free.
Yeah. Agreed. Hey, have a great week, Chris. Enjoy time with your family.
Too.
Hopefully get some time to relax and also just to reflect.
Likewise, my brother. Thank you, sir.
Talk to you soon, man.
See ya.